Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition. This week, everyone, we have the very lovely and talented Natasha Halevi. In fact, I hope that's how you pronounce her last name. I didn't even ask. But she came in here. Natasha, I met at my friend's wedding about 6 weeks ago at the same time that I met Mr. Sean Gunn, because they, everyone, are engaged to get married, which is very lovely. They're both super, super cool. And she was kind enough to agree to come in here on sort of short notice. We've been going back and forth on email for a few weeks, but she wedged me into her tight schedule to come in here and talk about The Graduate, everybody, one of my favorite movies ever. And we had a really good talk about it. It's a movie, as you will hear over the next hour or so, that changes for me as I watch it over the years. Every time I see it, as I get older, it takes on a little bit of a different tone. And she agreed, and we ended up having a really good talk about it. So without any delay, here we go with Natasha Halevi on The Graduate. Where are you from? Let's back up.
Okay, sorry. Let's back it on out. That's the backup sound.
Born in
Ventura, California.
Oh, okay.
Burned down last year.
Oh, that's right.
But, you know, that's what California does now.
Was your family there when that happened?
No, thank God. They were okay. Out. And weirdly, the whole neighborhood that I grew up in burned down, and our house was still standing.
Wow.
And I think my dad built a crazy irrigation system for the, like, orchard in the backyard. Orchard. I mean, it was like 7 trees, but listen, we called it an orchard. And I swear, I'm like, I think that crazy system you put in was just like kept that house standing. Anyway.
Maybe. Was it one of the only ones?
Yes.
Interesting. So you grew up there.
Grew up in Ventura.
And how long were you there?
Till I went to college. I went to college at UC Davis. I grew up there, spent my life there. We had like a short stint in the Valley, which was a really like totally important part of my growing up, because it was like just the age where you're really learning to be like totally yourself.
Yeah.
And I still will say like and dude when I get really excited about something. And I'm like, oh, my God, we lived there 1 year. How did this happen to me?
Oh, I think we all kind of do that. I say dude so much, it's kind of embarrassing.
Okay, I feel better.
And like, it's part of this generation, I think.
Like years of guilt over saying that just went away, thanks to you.
Yeah. when did you get into acting, though?
Like in the Valley. Which is sort of true. Mm-hmm. I was in a number of productions as like a child.
Oh, cool.
In Los Angeles.
Like stage stuff?
Stage stuff.
Uh-huh.
And this is really crazy. I did a film. We shot it about 2 years ago. It's not out yet. It has a lot of CGI in it. It's got talking animals. It's called Toby Goes to Camp.
Uh-huh.
And it's about kids at this like camp, and this tiger comes to camp, and all the cute things happen. And I'm like the tiger mom. We went and shot a day in a theater in the Valley.
Uh-huh.
And I walked into this theater and I was like,
oh no,
heck? I'm like, I think I was here when I was like all of 9 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I, like, texted my mom. I'm like, Mom. And I, like, took a picture. Of course, I wasn't supposed to take pictures of anything. I just sent it to my mom.
Was that it?
And she's like, yeah, that's definitely the theater you performed in as a child. And
that's
it was, like,
cool.
Such a funny thing. Anyway, I then did not – then I moved back to Ventura and started surfing.
Really?
and I don't know what happened with – you know, I do, like, shows in school.
Uh-huh.
But really – God, acting just like really has been a pain in my ass.
Really?
I went to school. When I went to college, uh-huh. I was going to, you know, I did a pre-med track. I was going to become a doctor.
Right.
I studied biology. And within my first few weeks of school, I was just looking for an improv team. I had done some improv. And I went to the theater department. And I said, hey, is there like an improv team? And they were like,
They said, yes, and?
Yes, and. But I'm, they said, oh, yeah, sure, come back this day. We're having auditions for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, cool. So I came back, and there was not an audition for an improv team. They did not have an improv team. They were auditions for the entire season of performances for that coming year.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't really know what I was doing, and I didn't have anything prepared. I didn't have a resume or whatever I was supposed to have with me, headshot. And I walked into the room, and all the guest directors and the other student directors and the staff directors, they were all there. And they were like, oh, you know, what do you have to perform for us today? And I was like,
wow.
I thought this was an improv thing. And they were like, oh. And I was like, and, you know, they're about to, like, dismiss me. And I was like, give me the name of an item in your pocket, sir. You know, and it was like a pen or whatever.
Wow,
and I was
so
like, okay. And I got my, like, three items. Uh-huh. And I performed a monologue at the tombstone of my grandfather with their three items.
And just improvised it?
Yeah. And I got cast in a bunch of shows for that year. And then
That's
by the
amazing.
End of that year, I finished my minor.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, I guess I have to get a major in theater now.
Yeah.
So that's what happened.
Really?
I still did the pre-med track. So I had a degree in theater and in biology.
Interesting combo.
And then I went on. I rock climbed a lot in college.
Uh-huh.
So I moved to Boulder, Colorado to climb for a summer after school and stayed for 8 years.
That is
sort of super long summer of climbing.
That's a very hippie thing to do.
Yeah.
I went to climb for 3 months and stayed for 8 years.
Yes.
Did you just climb and climb and climb?
No, I got a real job in design, which is neither of the degrees that I got, clearly.
Yeah. Did you just have a knack for it?
No, I became very interested in sustainability.
Okay.
Because I spent all my time outdoors and cared about protecting it and wanted to see that last, and then started seeing, oh, wow, that connects into all these other things, of course.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I just started doing research, and buildings were the biggest impact on the environment, which really isn't that shocking when you think about it. You know,
sure.
I thought, oh, it's cars, it's industry, but nope. We live in buildings. We work in buildings.
Wow.
So we're in buildings all the time. We use electricity. We use water.
Right.
You know, all the things we use, and we just like push the button and it's like the lights are on, and it's like, okay,
right.
But that came from somewhere. And
yes.
It's like, oh, you turn the water on and it's like, that's coming from a place.
Right.
You know?
It's easy to forget that.
It's so easy to forget. We have all these great buttons. They just do things.
Yeah.
Water button, light button.
Uh-huh. So there's a disconnect there.
TV button,
right.
Entertainment button.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Was it like LEED certification type of stuff? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've been a part of 30-some-odd LEED buildings.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
But I couldn't get away from acting. I would act a little bit in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And then I moved to LA, opened an office for the company I was working for, and started doing little films on the side. And then my boss said, well, we looked you up, HR looked you up online. And
what, because you're like moonlighting?
Yeah. It looks like you're an actress. And I was like,
thank you.
I know I was. But really what I said to him was, have you seen any of the obscure short films on that list on IMDb? And he was like, no. And I was like, well, I don't think you have anything to worry about. But the next day I called him up and I was like, you know, I really liked how that sounded. You
right.
said it looks like you're an actress, and you're right. I am.
Wow. That's so funny.
That was it.
And so you quit the job?
That was it. Yep. That
wow.
was it.
And then made a real go at it?
And then made a real go at it and still just going and going. I think that's how it goes forever, no matter
sure.
where you are as an actor.
Yeah, yeah. It's always a work in progress.
Go and go and go.
Now, I do want to know a little bit about BC Butcher.
Yeah.
Because explain to everyone what this project was, and there's sort of one really unique factor, if
yes.
I understand it correctly.
I think I'm going to give you the right unique factor. In my mind, there are a lot of unique factors, which we can definitely get into. But the really unique piece of BC Butcher is Kansas Bowling.
Right.
She is the writer-director.
Mm-hmm.
And when she made this film, I went in – before I give it away.
Yeah, yeah.
I went in to audition for Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
I walked into the room and there was, you know, someone I don't know, maybe in their 30s or 40s. And then there was also a girl there reading. And I was like, okay. And she's like, I'll be reading with you. And I was like, okay, great. And I thought, you know, that makes sense based on the story for sure. Like, yeah. That's the right age. And we read, and she, like, you know, we had a really great read. It was a lot of fun. And she was like, okay, you know, great, thanks. And I was like, okay, bye. And then I get a phone call a couple days later, and it's the same, like, young girl's voice. Hi, this is Kansas Bowling. I'm the director of the film, and, you know, we read together. And I'm just, like, on the phone, and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It's happening right now. This is the girl I read with. She's, like, one of the actors, for sure. Nope. Kansas Bowling, at age 17.
Amazing.
Wrote, directed, cast, funded, you know, got the money, and made a film.
That's amazing.
Shot it on 16 millimeter film.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Which was incredible. It was so much fun to shoot on film.
Sure.
You know, like, wow. So cool. Such a different feeling when you, when you're, you know, performing. It's a different, it feels, it almost, there's something about it that feels a little bit more like performing on a stage just because, you know, the way we treat film and the way we treat digital.
Right.
You know, digital, it's like, oh, let's just do it again, do it again, do it again.
A thousand times, sure.
And film, it's like, okay, this is what we're doing now.
Yeah, there's a, I mean, I was about to say it's
if
a finite
a budget,
resource.
Sure.
It's not like they're running out of film.
Yeah.
But if you're on a budget, it is a finite resource.
It's totally a finite resource.
Like the number of film cans, you can, and I used to work on projects like that. It's like, well, we have this much film.
Oh, yeah.
So let's just sort of back into to it that way.
Yeah. She wasn't calling the studio and saying, actually, I need some more film in like 10 more days.
Yeah, yeah.
When we signed the contract with Kansas, I was signing it. And I looked at her. I was like, you know, this contract is immediately null and void.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not old enough to sign this contract.
She's like, just humor me.
Yeah. I was like, so if this movie makes money, do you promise, please, that you'll pay me, even though this contract is not real? Yeah.
So how'd it go, though? I mean, what was it like, and how was she?
Kansas is awesome. Uh-huh. She's actually working on a film right now. Uh-huh. She's done a ton of music videos. She's really she's so into music.
Yeah.
You could talk to her about, I mean, her brain and music is, like, the most mind-blowing thing. And she has, like, this really amazing artistic, creative brain that links things together that, like, I don't even comprehend. She's great.
Mm-hmm.
She was 17 and
that's really
had
impressive.
100% control over her set, over her team, and killed it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she's awesome.
And how old is she now? Like, was
22.
Oh, okay. So that was a little bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
So she's a veteran at this point.
Oh, yeah. She's like, she's been at it. Yeah. And that film, she sold that film to Troma.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is very cool.
It's very cool.
Legendary. I mean, what are they? Distribution company, I guess?
They are. No, they definitely are a
production company.
Yeah. Very much so. Lloyd Kaufman just shot Shakespeare's Shitstorm. I know he's always working on projects. And Lloyd saw something special in Kansas and brought Kansas and I to San Diego Comic Con. Here we are, like, we have no idea what's going on. We're like, what? You know, there are all these huge films at Comic Con, right?
Yeah.
You know, like that same year, Guardians of the Galaxy had their big, like, stage thing. You know, all these huge films are there and everyone's being escorted around, and, you know, Troma's not being escorted around.
Yeah, but Troma has this, I mean, they're legendary, you know?
They've
been around forever, and if you know, like, if you're a cinephile and you know film, then you know Troma.
Yeah.
And they have earned that reputation over the years for doing some of the most creative, sort of great, you know, schlocky genre pictures you could imagine.
Yes.
And those are all complimentary words. You know?
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. Very much so. Yeah. Lloyd Kaufman is amazing. He finds people who have talent and aren't afraid to have a different viewpoint of the world than mainstream anything. In fact, if anybody had a mainstream viewpoint on the world, he'd probably tell them to go.
Right. You're not Troma material.
Yeah.
It's really admirable, though. It's cool that they're still at it after all these years.
Yes.
What? Where can people see that?
That is on Amazon. It's on iTunes. It is also available through Troma. Troma has their own streaming service. They have a subscription service, so Troma definitely can have it. Has it, and that's a. I feel like I should like know the URL. It's troma.com. I think it's that's probably what it is.
I can't wait to check it out. What give everyone a quick plot synopsis.
Oh my goodness. It is basically the most outrageous cave women, cave women story.
Sure.
Cave women story sounds weird.
About cave women.
It's a bunch of cave women struggling to get through life's daily obstacles when all of a sudden something happens.
That's a good tease.
Yeah, I feel like that was like a total bullshit answer, but is pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Without giving anything away. There's now, a monster, you guys.
Well, I figured it is Troma after all.
Yes.
What else are you going out for these days? What do you got anything exciting
on
the horizon?
Oh, man. Well, I'm in Atlanta a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I actually met my fiance in Atlanta. We
sure.
were both working.
Former guest Sean Gunn.
He was working on a slightly larger project than I was working on. Infinity War, and I was working on.
To be fair, that's larger than every project.
Yeah, I know that is true. You know? I could basically say I was working on anything else, and it would be a larger project. But we met here in Atlanta while we were both working.
Oh, cool.
And I was on a project for like 3 weeks, and then we came back and bought a house, and just finished fixing it up. So we're here in Atlanta, and. Both of us have our eyes on things that are shooting in Atlanta. He for a whole different, set of, type of character than I'm looking for. And I'm just, that's my focus right now is really on what's shooting in Atlanta and getting out for that stuff. And I love my team here in Atlanta. They're amazing.
That's great.
I'm shooting something else with Kansas in two weeks from now back in LA.
So she's
with her
LA
new
based?
Film. Yes.
Okay.
She's LA. And then I'm also working on my own project, which is sort of a weird near future sci-fi based on the work of Ray Kurzweil.
Who's that?
Who is a futurist.
Okay. I know that name.
He now works for Google, but he was at MIT for years.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically his whole life revolves around the singularity.
Gotcha.
And he believes that in our lifetime, the singularity will occur.
Oh, man.
And he's basically just trying to eat really well and stay alive long enough for that to happen.
Wow.
So my story is really based on, you start to think about what would happen if the singularity occurred.
Sure.
Who would get that technology first and who would be
right.
advanced first and what it would mean to modify and what it would mean if we could live forever
yeah.
or live as long as we wanted and how that would create classes. And then, you start seeing this ball roll down and then you're like, okay, so what happens after all that occurs?
So that's what you've been writing? Or?
So that's we've shot some in L.A., some in Atlanta. We're shooting in Atlanta the next couple of days, Friday, Monday we're shooting.
So is this a film or a pilot?
This is a mess. No, it's not. This is actually being created in 60-second episodes.
Oh, interesting.
And that's partly because that's what we watch now. And it's partly not just because that's what we watch. It's because Instagram comes in 60-second videos.
Right.
So it's a real difficult thing to play with because it's almost like it's a big story to tell in short snippets of time. So it's a really interesting, different way to look at film as art.
Yeah.
And I think I like that when I'm working on my own smaller projects to say, okay, this is my art. So
right.
how do I really want to look at art? As opposed to if I was making something for a studio,
right.
would I look at it?
Sure.
So it's an opportunity to play.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're working in these 60-second pieces that have, there's something about it that almost feels like you're cutting a trailer because you have to provide information in a different way than we're used to hearing a story and seeing a story play out. So it's been really fun to piece this together, and it's really helped my brain see storytelling as that art form again instead of as the corporate rules we have to follow or, you know, go, you have to take this route. And if you're, you know, you have to have this person, whatever it is, all of that goes away because it's really about creating the story in through art.
Yeah, yeah.
Through moving picture art.
Is it going to be 60-second stories that all link together to tell a larger whole?
Yes. Wow. It is all one story.
Okay.
But they are – so we are following all the same characters throughout the entire series. But they are 60-second snippets that really do sort of tie. It's almost like there's a loop that ties each one together, and the loop starts becoming clear as it progresses. So the story is told a little inside out, really.
Now, are you releasing this on Instagram?
It will be released on Instagram.
Has anyone done this before?
You know what?
Because it sounds like a great idea.
I know. I thought I was so cool in coming up with a great idea, but since I obviously did research on what this would entail, there are some things like this that have happened on Instagram.
All
but
right.
since Instagram TV came out, a lot of it's moved sort of that direction.
Gotcha.
Instagram TV doesn't have that limit, but I really liked that limit.
Yeah, yeah.
It really forced me to stop trying to make a film the way I know how to do it and start trying to look at it as art.
Yeah, and get really creative.
It's really creative. Yeah.
That's super cool.
It's been so helpful for me in all the other ways too, you know, in acting opportunities and it's just really opened up a lot in
my brain. Well, and making your own opportunities is, I mean, I suppose people have always tried to do that, but it seems like more than ever now people are saying, well, you know what? I can go out and audition and that's all great, but I can also get busy myself. Because it's so accessible now, and there are so many formats for distribution, and like, I think that's really cool.
Yes, I think another key part about it being a weird sort of artistic thing in this little form has really helped me get out of the mindset of being like, oh, I'm going to make whatever a YouTube series so that somebody will see it and will pick me up and will want me to do it. I've really been able to focus on the art of making it.
Yep.
And
that's the
honestly,
right
that's
way to do it, I think.
That's the way that I'll, you know, ever be able to create the way I want to create anyway.
Right.
But it's allowed me to just like let go of all that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, of course, I'll like keep it locked down and only distribute it to certain people first. So it's not that I won't be smart about it. It's not that I don't care about that, because that's the only way you can really get your ideas and your stories to the amount of people you want to share that with.
Yeah.
So I don't mean to disregard how important that is, but I feel very lucky that I can really make it about the art.
Yeah, that's really great. Well, you'll have to let me know when that starts to be released I'll blast it out to the movie crushers.
Thank you.
So let's dive into The Graduate.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, first of all, you were kind enough to make a last-minute switch because your original pick, Once Upon a Time in the West, great film, great epic three-hour Western. But I was like, you know what? I said, if you have it in you, do you mind switching it up just because maybe we'll go with something that's sometimes a little more accessible for listeners, and you were kind enough to send me a great list. But I do want to hear quickly about your Once Upon a Time in the West Christmas tradition.
I will tell you.
Which is very odd.
Well, there are two things I learned in our email exchange. One is that Once Upon a Time in the West is not on any best movies list anywhere.
That surprises me.
Which really surprises me because I'm like, this is everyone's favorite movie, right? Okay. Turns out it's not everyone's favorite movie. This is how wrong my brain is. Two, in my head, it's a Christmas movie. It's not a Christmas movie. There are no Christmas-related scenes in this movie.
No, there aren't.
But a number of years ago, I started watching Once Upon a Time in the West on Christmas Day. It's my Christmas movie.
Now, was this a family thing or was
No, I was with a friend, Naomi Rama. she and I had a breakfast brunch for everyone. It was one of those years where, like,
sure,
I don't
Christmas.
Know, the family yeah. wasn't interested in me. They were like, get over your acting career and get a job.
I think we've all
don't
had
come
those
home for Christmas.
Those holidays, friends holidays.
No, my family is fantastic. They're very supportive, but it was a friends of friends Christmas.
Yeah.
And everyone had gone. We had had the house was we were at my house. It was a catastrophe. We'd had mimosas. There were like champagne bottles uh-huh. everywhere. And the sun was starting to set. And I was like, let's watch a movie. And then she yeah. was like, okay, well, what do you really want to watch? And I was like, I really want to watch a Western. She was like, okay. And I'm like, I really want to watch a beautiful Western.
Yeah.
She's like, okay. And then I was like, start flipping through. And I was like, oh, Once Upon a Time in the West. Uh-huh. Most beautiful film ever. And you're right. It is a 3-hour Western. Turns out it is kind of long and it's kind of boring.
Oh, I don't think it's boring.
It's beautiful.
It is.
It's the most beautifully shot, most beautifully paced film.
Uh-huh.
And man, those dusters. Oh,
yeah.
So good. So good.
So then you started watching that every year?
Every Christmas. Every Christmas we watch uh-huh. it. Sean and I watched it last year.
Okay, so he's indulged this?
Yes. Thank God. Otherwise we wouldn't be getting married.
Right.
If I couldn't watch Once Upon a Time in the West on Christmas Day, uh-huh. game over.
Well, you have you were very sweet, though, in deciding to switch it to The Graduate, which 1967, directed by Mike Nichols, written by Buck Henry and Calder Willingham from a novel,
mm-hmm.
Which has a sequel, too, which I didn't know that. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, there's a sequel that finally came out just about 10 years ago called Homeschooled.
Homeschooled. And it's like The Graduate, but happens earlier because being homeschooled happens before graduate school.
Yeah, it's actually the reviews were not kind. It basically picks up the story of Benjamin and Elaine later when they are trying to homeschool their children.
Oh, my God.
And it's supposedly – like the one review I saw said that why did he even keep these characters because it has nothing to do with who they are or – It's a sequel in name only.
Also,
which
I'm
just weird.
Like devastated right now that you just told me it's about their lives in the future having children that they're homeschooling because when you watch them ride away
yeah.
on that bus, their faces
yeah,
say
well, let's
so
talk about that.
Much.
We can go backwards.
Oh my! Yeah, we're gonna start with the end of the movie.
Yeah, no,
is that
that's
okay?
Because that's one of the most iconic shots in movie history.
So,
is how their
God.
Elation. From the time they get on that bus, they're laughing, and that turns into reality in about 12 seconds.
Seconds. In seconds, they realize that they've
– like, what have we done?
So much. It's not just what have they done. Some of this realization that I'm going to say is related – we are doing this out of order.
Which is fine.
Wait, but let me just say what I'm saying, why I'm so devastated about knowing this book exists. I am so devastated to know that they would have children or that they would have stayed together because when I watch them on that bus, I think, well, you know, there really is a feeling when you look at them and you see their faces that they probably are going to stick it out and that it sucks.
Yeah.
But I had hoped, mostly for Elaine, that she would have been like, screw this.
Yeah.
I have things to do.
Well.
I have a life to live and I'm amazing and I went to Berkeley,
yeah,
no big deal,
right?
You know, and see you later, buddy.
Yeah, no, I think that,
but that's not what happens. They have kids, and they try to homeschool them.
I mean, you can just forget that because it's just so weird. Like, I think this movie stands by itself as far as how people want to read that ending, because I doubt if there are many people out there, fans of the film, that would say like, "Oh yeah, these two are just bound for lifelong success.
They're gonna have such a good life together."
Because he has. I mean, I love this movie so much, but it's interesting now to look at it as an adult and be like, man, this guy has an affair with a married woman that the daughter finds out about it. He takes her out, treats her awfully. She breaks up with him, rightfully so. He basically stalks her at college.
Stalker.
And ruins her wedding and future marriage.
Yeah.
And it, you can't help get the feeling at like my age when you watch it is like, was this conquest for him or because the romance of it didn't like hit me as much last night as it had in the past.
Yeah. You know what? It's really funny. I feel like what you just said is so important. People who have seen this movie at a younger age will say, oh, I really understand and I relate to that character. And then years later, watch it again and say, what? That guy's such a D-bag.
Yeah.
Like, he's nothing. He really is.
Yeah, I know.
And of course, part of that is Dustin Hoffman's performance.
Sure.
He really plays that nothing so much. And you do see it when you're older, I think.
And I think that's kind of the point, maybe.
I think so, too. And I think that's a really special thing that a movie can do. I mean, sure, there are lots of movies we go back and watch and we might say, like, oh, I didn't see it that way. But this is really different.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think part of that also relates to why this movie is still so relevant.
Uh-huh.
Because it's relevant for, like, every generation. Because it's a movie about generations.
Mm-hmm.
And the fight to be your own self as a generation.
Yeah.
You know, so like especially now, I think it's so pertinent in our this as the millennials, the millennials.
Yeah.
I totally qualify as a millennial according to all the guidelines of millennials.
Right.
And I'm speaking as if I'm not. But millennials are, you know, so looked down upon and have so much creativity and so much to offer. And their obstacles, our obstacles, are so different. You know, you could buy a house on a single income. You know, their parents, the millennials' parents, my parents, could buy a house on a single income. You can't rent an apartment in Los Angeles on a single income. You can't rent a studio in Los Angeles on a single income.
Yeah.
And with so much of the United States. So, like, the struggles that the millennials have are, you know, it's just like, don't tell me that they're sitting around being lazy. They are working their butts off in very different ways.
Yeah.
But they're paying – the amount of money they have to expend is just – crazy compared to other generations. So, you know, there's this clear The Graduate has these generations. There's the adults that, you know, are Mrs. and Mr. And then there are the teenagers, or not the teenagers. They're not teenagers. Well, they're 21.
I think Catherine Ross is supposed to be 19 and he's just turns 21.
He just turns
film.
21 in the film. He has a birthday party, which is a spectacular scene.
Yeah, it's really great. One of the best scenes with the scuba.
It really is. And you know what? I also watched it last night. And that was the first time I saw that scene with the scuba gear and noticed how much there was a play with that fish tank. You know, you see keys when Mrs. Robinson throws her keys into the fish tank, it lands on top of the scuba guy.
Yeah.
And you all of a sudden seeing him in that pool, I was like, man, if some keys landed on top of him, he'd sure not have any choices.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem to really have a choice.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem to have a spine.
Yeah. It's
interesting.
He doesn't
make decisions.
And I caught the water thing too. And the clear divide of the generations is so important in this movie because it's these two younger characters. And like you said, everyone else is a Mr. or a Mrs. They're parents and parents' friends.
They're nameless.
They're just nameless.
They're just Mr. and Mrs. whatever.
Yeah, and they all kind of run together, especially in those scenes, the birthday party and then, of course, that very first sort of graduation celebration when everyone's just – it's just like a blur of nameless adults saying, what are you going to do with your life?
It's such a blur. It's shot so beautifully.
Yeah.
You really, you know, none of it's actually blurry, but it is such a blur. And I was looking at those shots for both the birthday party and for that scene that we open up with for with his graduation party. And it's so amazing that I could see clearly everyone's face, but I couldn't.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, how did this shot happen?
Yeah.
I really feel like I can't see these adults.
Uh-huh.
Also, they come at the angles, you know, you really feel like he's almost made to be like a child, not just a 20-year-old going on 21.
Well, they treat him like a 12-year-old through the whole movie, especially like with the scuba thing.
Oh, the scuba
very
thing.
Very silly. It reminded me of all things, A Christmas Story, when they make Ralphie dress up in the pink bunny costume and parade downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing, though.
It's the same thing.
I mean, he might as well be 8 years old.
Yeah.
And they're like, come on out here with your new gift.
Come out.
And he tries to get out, and they're shoving him back in with the mask.
Oh, my gosh. They put their hands right on his mask and shove his face back in the water. You know what happens when you shove people's faces in the water?
I know.
They drown. That's how you kill someone.
Well,
and it feels like that. They are. They're killing him.
Yeah, it's almost
like
a horror movie at times.
It is.
He's like being descended upon in every direction.
Every direction.
And it's almost at the same time, though, his dad expects him to be an adult. Because he has those conversations about, what are you going to do? Like, I get it. You're laying around drinking beer for a few weeks. But, like, what can we expect of you? And it's like, you haven't treated him like an adult yet. Why would you expect him to behave like one?
Yeah. That's interesting. I sort of never really even thought about that, even though it's so clear.
And he's so great in it, too. Huge shout out to the nameless adults. But William Daniels is his father. Elizabeth Wilson is Miss Braddock. Who has that great overreaction when they say they're getting engaged, when she screams at the top of her lungs.
That scream, that scream is so funny. It really, like the microphone, like, peaks.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you're like,
so over the top.
Oh, this was great. That's how somebody, I laughed so hard.
Yeah, I did too.
It's so funny. There's so
one.
Many funny moments. Yeah, so many funny
moments. Well, it's hysterical. It's one of these sort of rare movies that is so funny. But at the same time, there's just the sad subtext through everything. It's such a depressing movie while being funny.
Yeah. You know, it's a movie that I think it's not like you love or hate it. You
right.
love and hate it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt that way the first time I saw it. The first time I saw it was at this theater in Oakland. I was an adult, but I was definitely a young adult.
Yeah.
And it was this theater called the Paramount Theater that shows old movies.
Sure.
And they do like a whole show beforehand, and they've got like an organ player.
Oh, that's
and
great.
So I saw it on 35mm film at this 35mm print at this theater. And the theater itself was like a 1930s Art Deco theater, and just it was kind of like ostentatious, you know, but also in a very fun way. And it felt – seeing that movie felt so big for me when I saw it there. And I felt so almost embarrassed to be watching it. I felt like I hated what was going on.
Yeah.
I think I felt embarrassed in the ways that I related to Benjamin, which is hard to explain because it's no mm-hmm. obvious way. It's just that feeling of being in a place where you are ready, you want to be an adult and you're trying to grow up, but you are trying to fight growing up into that generation that you see as the grown-ups.
Right.
So it's like you want to be a grown-up, but you want to diverge and do it your own way.
Right.
And that is every generation.
Yeah.
And so having those feelings and watching that, I did feel this like real uneasy feeling.
Yeah.
And I loved it and very much hated it at mm-hmm. the same time.
Yeah, there is a discomfort. And that great – it reminds me of that great scene that's – they have all these great long scenes. And the one after they've been having the affair for a little while, when they have that great scene where he's like, can we just have a conversation?
Oh.
And that scene is so long and so sad because it begins with him just begging for something more substantial than jumping into bed with her. And they go through the whole gamut of emotions, and it ends with him taking his clothes off and saying like, nah, let's just not even bother talking.
Oh. Watching them
so
take their
sad.
Both of them, watching both of them take their clothes off at the end of that.
Ugh.
And him give up, but also she really gives up there. She like takes her bra off and tosses it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of funny because you're like watching this sort of like, okay, we're just gonna take our clothes off and have sex now.
Right.
But you know, for him, I think that maybe that's the difference for me in watching it as an older adult than watching it as a younger adult. I'm not that old, you guys.
Now that you're 60.
Yeah. But seeing her pain a lot more, instead of seeing her as this like aggressor and seeing her as this weird seductor, seeing her as this, you know, woman that's hurting and seeing her as a mother that's protective.
Yeah.
And seeing that, seeing her not want to talk to him,
mm-hmm.
but actually seeing her want to talk to him. You know, she doesn't want Elaine to him to date Elaine. She doesn't want Elaine to be hurt by him. And part of that is she doesn't she wants to protect her daughter, but part of it is she wants him too.
Yeah, yeah.
And seeing, and you really see that in that scene because she's, oh, I don't want to, you know, she does all this not wanting to talk to him and then starts talking. And you see the moment that she opens up and she is looking for a little bit something more too. And then, you know, that conversation just doesn't go right because it's not what he wants.
Right.
He doesn't understand those things. And she, of course, knew that. That's why she never wanted to have the conversation to begin with. So you see her in this whole different, for me, this last time I watched it, in a whole different light. And I just felt for her so much as she threw her bra onto the ground.
I know. It's so sad. I mean, the whole movie is kind of in that scene. And I think Nichols knew that because it's so long and just uninterrupted. And it is sad to see, like, I think she did want a connection.
Yeah.
But also didn't.
Yes.
Because she's at a place in her marriage where she married this, she even admits that she married him because she got pregnant.
Right.
He has money and she's bored and not satisfied sexually or emotionally.
Not satisfied, period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right. Like, in any way.
You know, it's interesting because I saw these little things too that she would do that really Nichols was able to, you know, show through these shots in the bar at their house.
Yeah.
There's this.
Which is, by the way, that set, that living room was amazing.
Please, can somebody give me that bar?
The bar, so great.
Please, why can't I have that house?
Yeah.
Whoever has that house, please, can you just give it to me?
Emily and I were watching it last night. We were total house envy.
Oh my gosh. That bar is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Ugh. So there are these two alcohol containers, decanters, whatever they are.
Yeah.
And it says on it, like, Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Or no, it doesn't. I lied.
Oh, okay.
Guys, I'm making stuff up about the movie, and when you watch it, it won't be there. It says on it scotch and bourbon, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And one is the queen and the king of a chessboard.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny because in the first scene where he's offered a drink, she pours out of her thing. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what Ben says.
Right.
The adults are going to pour from their container.
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't matter what he asks for. They always ask him, what do you want to, you know, what do you want, this or that? And they pour.
The opposite.
Yeah. You know, because Mr. Robinson also pours a drink later.
Because he says scotch, right? Mm-hmm. And he goes bourbon.
Yeah.
But he
and
pours
he
him
pours
scotch.
Him scotch. And he pours out of the Mr. container.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and you see
that
there are these things that she's even doing, like, you know, like to be her own person.
Wow.
You know, like that's her drink.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's almost like this, like these two, the Mr. and Mrs. sitting there, the king and the queen at the bar, which clearly, you know, she says she has alcohol. She's an alcoholic.
Yeah. Did you know I'm an alcoholic?
Yeah. Did you know I'm an alcoholic? And so that king and the queen at the bar, I think, are so much more important. And you see it over and over again in future shots.
Wow, I never noticed that.
I think it's
that's what makes this
part of her
one
saying,
of the
you know, like I am a person.
Uh-huh.
I have a purpose. I am here too. It's not just, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Robinson.
Right.
We are individuals, and almost maybe part of that is trying to like get that attention from him.
Yeah.
You know,
and he calls her Mrs. Robinson the whole time.
Mrs. Robinson,
like in bed, midway through the affair, he's still calling her that.
Absolutely.
And she's so like. She's so manipulative of him to just make this all happen to begin with and kind of throughout because she's, I think, the older woman who, by the way, she's 36 years old.
Yes.
I'm 47.
He was 29 when they shot and she was 30, 35, turned 36 while they were shooting, I believe.
6 years older.
Yes.
Which is crazy.
Yes.
And his dad was only 10 years older than him when they shot
it. Right, right. Yeah, but oh, wow. Like knowing that and watching her performance.
I know.
She doesn't question her age at all. She is twice his age.
Yep.
And there's no question. And you're like, you are mind blowing right now.
Yeah. I mean, she's.
What a performance.
Amazing. Like so like sexy and confident, but also like just tragically sad and vulnerable, but also manipulating him like at every turn.
She carries so much of the life of the scenes between the two of them.
Yeah.
Because he has to be, I mean, I'm not, certainly not critiquing that performance, but Ben is so boring and he's so easily manipulated and he wants to be manipulated. Yet he wants to be his own self, but he won't do anything.
He
about
doesn't have
it.
The spine, like you
he
said.
He doesn't have the spine
to do anything.
And so, because that's all he is, she has to be so much, not just as a performer, but in at those characters. She uh-huh. has to be the one that guides.
Sure.
Literally guides, like, go get the hotel room.
Yeah.
You know,
do
she
I need
has
to get
to,
the room,
yes.
or can you do this?
She has
Again,
to.
Again, treating him like a child, though, like everyone else.
Yes. He's behaving like a child.
Yeah, I know.
He's behaving like a child. He wants to grow up, but isn't doing anything about it.
I know. And he, like, I feel like he doesn't even have any purpose until that third act where he falls for Elaine and then, like, goes to Berkeley to essentially stalk her.
Yes.
Which is interesting, though, you know, because, again, like, watching it as an adult, I was like, is he really in love with her or is this something to do?
Oh, God, it's so
like
much
he finally
that.
Has a purpose.
What an infatuation.
Yeah.
It's something to do. It's infatuation. It's also, you know, it's not on accident that Elaine is Mrs. Robinson's daughter.
Right.
And it's very interesting to see, you know, he fall – when you look at it from this perspective of this, like, generation gap, the, you know – his age, Ben and Elaine,
right.
and then the Misters and the Mrs. and Mrs. Robinson,
uh-huh.
he, you know, doesn't want to be an adult like the adults he's seen. He's
yeah.
not going to do it, you know. He's not going to do it. But then he sort of does do it because he goes to Mrs. Robinson, you know,
uh-huh.
has the affair with Mrs. Robinson, and he starts to inherently sort of all because he starts growing up in that way, in the
yeah.
way of that generation. He's going directly, literally directly into that generation.
Yeah.
You know, very sexually into that generation. He's saying, like, okay, this is my next step. I go be them.
Right.
And he goes to be them and then realizes, no, that's not what growing up is.
Yeah.
I'm my own thing, especially with Elaine, who has this she's very much a child.
Uh-huh.
You know, she literally cries like a child. She laughs like a child. She talks like a child.
Yeah.
But she goes to Berkeley.
Right.
She's smart. She goes to the school that's
future.
She has a real future. And she goes to that school where things happen.
Yeah.
You know? And he meets her and it's like, oh, no, that's what he wants. That's I want to be of my generation. I want to be this generation. Yet – it's Mrs. Robinson's daughter. So he's really, you know, if you become your mother,
yeah.
you become your father, he's really just doing the same thing anyway. He can't fight the fact that he's
yeah.
going to grow up and be the older generation. And
yeah.
that is what's going to happen to all of us. We grow up and then we're the older generation and we look at the younger generation and we talk to them like children.
Yeah.
And Kansas Bowling makes a film at age 17.
Right.
And we're like, why are we talking to anyone younger than ourselves like children? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. And he's just such a lost little boy through the whole movie. And he never, as evidenced by that last scene on the bus, like I think he still has not found himself at all.
Yes.
I don't think as a character arc, he ends up in any different place than
no.
when he's staring into the void at the beginning of that movie when, you know, that great first line is ladies and gentlemen, we are about to begin our descent into Los Angeles. And
yes.
it has that pullback on the plane. And he's just lost whether he's staring in the fish tank or he's just – he finally realizes in the scuba scene he's happy down there.
Oh, yeah.
Which Wes Anderson totally steals in Rushmore.
Oh, yes.
When Bill Murray
very much.
Jumps in
uh-huh.
in the swimming pool and just sort of floats down.
Yep. And who hasn't been in a swimming pool and feel that way?
No, I totally agree. It's one of the most comforting feelings to be down there by yourself.
Yeah. That swimming pool, yes, he does. He finds comfort in being down there.
Yeah.
Again, later when his parents are saying he should go out with Elaine and they're circling him like sharks. He's
uh-huh.
on the raft and they're circling him.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he ends up in the water and he just stays down there and that's where we leave that scene.
Yeah.
Just the being, you know, he wants to shut it all off instead of confront it,
yeah.
you know, and you see that with the scuba.
Anything.
He puts the gear on and that shot is so beautiful
uh-huh.
and you feel it's so beautiful and it's so funny and you there's so many fun things about that shot, but the adults' faces popping into the
uh-huh.
into the mask and they look so ridiculous and they're shouting, but you can't hear them because all you hear is the
yeah, yeah. Well, that's one of three times.
That wasn't a Darth Vader. That was meant to be the scuba gear.
That's one of three times in the movie, though, that Nichols used that technique of seeing people talking but not hearing. It's that scene.
The car.
In the car.
When they're eating.
Yeah, the drive-in. And then at the very end in the church.
Yes.
When it's zooming in at all those harsh Dutch angles of everyone, like, clearly cussing him out. But you don't hear anything at all.
You don't hear any of it.
It really works, too, for the movie, I think.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? I didn't really think about it in that last scene. The car was the one that came to mind, which
right.
I do think is really interesting because it's in that scene, he and Elaine are in the car and they, like, shut, you know, close the top down and roll the windows up because they want it to be quiet so they
right.
can talk.
Uh-huh.
But the quiet they're trying to get away from is the music and the people of
kids.
Their own generation. Yeah. And so they're
trying –
you really see that feeling
yeah.
of, oh, we're going to try to be little adults. And it's like they're really having a hard time deciding if they want to be – just repeat the last generation's work or be their own generation.
Right.
And you see that there. But what's really interesting in the last scene, I read somewhere that scene was – that whole church scene was meant to sort of play to or not play to, but like almost mimic
mm-hmm.
a scene from something called Girl Shy that was a silent film.
Oh.
And it's really interesting to realize for the first time because you're saying it that, of course, there's no – you don't hear anybody talking during that. And I don't think it was meant to mimic the silent movie aspect
right.
of it. I think it was meant to more show this kind of chase and the people in the way and all the things you have to fight through to get to this
right.
girl. But I think they're, you know, I see that now in a different light with that silence that's going on there, how you can't hear
uh-huh.
anyone shouting. You know, when you really want something and you're going after something, you don't hear people shouting.
Yeah.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
All that does go away.
That's interesting.
But you can see them. You know they're there.
Right.
You know it's in your face and you're just still like struggling
yeah.
through and you're going your direction no matter what the shouting is. You shut it off.
Yeah. I mean, that's why this is one of the great, great all-time movies is there's so much going on here. And it's almost like Catcher in the Rye in that I read that book about every 15 years and it's something different every time. As you age, it changes along with your perspective. But
yes.
it's
what's
on top
what's
of all
main,
that.
The main character?
Oh, Holden Caulfield.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard that the author of the book, The Graduate, really thought of Ben as Holden.
Well, there are some parallels to
yeah.
be sure.
Yeah, for
the adults
sure.
being phonies and all that stuff.
So, of course, you know, it is one of those stories
yeah.
that you can go back to.
But this is one of those that when you're younger, when I first saw this, I think maybe when I was in high school, like it can also just be a really funny movie.
Oh, it's so funny.
Like if you're not reading in and catching a lot of the subtext, it's just fucking funny. Dustin Hoffman is hysterical. All those little whines and whimpers that he does the whole time.
Oh, my gosh. It is so funny. It was, Mike Nichols was – he comes from a comedy background.
Yeah, uh-huh.
In Chicago, and he had a whole show that he did with another woman,
Elaine May.
May and Nichols.
Who was actually in this briefly. She has a little cameo.
Where? How did I miss that?
She plays Elaine's student friend that gives him the note.
Oh, my gosh.
And she's apparently like 39 when she's supposed to be playing a college
student. Of course, of course.
They're fast and loose with the ages in this movie.
Of course.
Which they kind of had to be, which I thought was funny.
You know who else makes a little cameo at the desk? Maybe you caught it.
Well, there are a couple of...
At the desk, I'm like having like a brain memory...
Are you talking about Richard Dreyfuss?
No. Oh, God.
Because he's in it.
That, like, I never knew that before until last night.
You want me to call the cops?
Sean and I were watching it. And we were like, was that Richard Dreyfuss?
Oh, yeah.
No, at the desk, the guy
well,
who checks
Buck Henry.
In. Yes.
Yeah.
Who really is – there are three credited screenwriters on this, but he's really credited
right,
Nichols as
sure.
being the actual writer of this.
Yeah.
Who also, of course, has a comedy background
yeah.
as well, you know.
Emily was asking like who Buck Henry is. So I was like, well, he's a writer and humorist and like sometimes actor, but he was on SNL as sort of a guest.
He was writing Get Short while he was writing The Graduate.
Oh, really?
He would write The Graduate at night. He was staying at what is it? You know, the Chateau Marmont.
Oh, sure.
In Los Angeles, and working uh-huh. and was writing that script during the day.
Wow.
And then at night was writing The Graduate.
Jeez.
So he didn't sleep.
We have to talk about Simon and Garfunkel a little bit.
Oh, yeah,
let's. Because people would kill us if we did not mention this. Their part in this movie is as big as any of the actors, and it's such a through line. And I've always loved their music, and so I was always just like, yeah, man, the Simon and Garfunkel there is great.
Right.
But now, like, watching it again through different eyes, it so sets a tone and chapterizes the movie with those great montages. And during every montage, whether it's The Sound of Silence or Scarborough Fair, Benjamin and all the characters really come out the other side of that in a different place.
Yes, very much so. Well, and you hear A Sound of Silence comes back, you know, numerous times, but
yeah.
It is definitely in the opening credits with that shot at, you know, the Los Angeles airport.
That, so good.
You know, you just have
to. The moving sidewalk.
Yeah, you start watching great. That moving sidewalk and you're watching, you know, Ben standing there. You know immediately who you're going to see the rest of that film.
Yep. Without
you
any words
so
or anything.
So much about him.
Yeah, it's all in his face.
And just that moving sidewalk with The Sound of Silence and Ben just being that spineless nothing.
Yeah.
Already.
I know.
I have so much judgment towards him already.
I do too.
Just in that opening credit sequence.
Yeah. Which is not how I used to view that character, you know? Mm-hmm. I always thought like, oh, he's a romantic and
what a cool guy.
Yeah, but he's not.
I want to be like him.
He's
I
not.
Could go up to Berkeley and chase a girl and she'll fall for me. Stalker.
Yeah.
Stalker.
Really interesting. Well, let me go through a few. We're shorter on time today than usual and I want to give you the full five-question ending,
okay.
But here's a little bit of trivia, which I thought was interesting. Mrs. Robinson was turned down by Geraldine Page, Doris Day, Patricia Neal, Joan Crawford, Audrey Hepburn, and Lauren Bacall, and Ava Gardner tried, like, chase down this part, and he would not give them the part. Elaine was turned down by Patty Duke, Sally Field, Shirley MacLaine, and Faye Dunaway. And Jane Fonda, Goldie Hawn, and Candace Bergen all screen tested. And then before he finally settled on Dustin Hoffman, precisely because he was awkward and small and sort of a nebbish, he almost cast Warren Beatty or Robert Redford, which he was just like, no, they're too hot. Yeah, they're too hot.
Yeah. And Dustin Hoffman's not.
No.
Sorry,
and
buddy.
He was great.
Sorry, buddy. But he was the, like, weird, nerdy guy.
Yeah.
And actually, I've heard that, you know, or read that was the moment that finally Nichols was able to piece the movie together.
Oh, with
Hoffman. Was when he realized it was Hoffman and not who you would expect to be, like the rich kid who went to school and did well and was accepted into all the Mr. Suave.
Yeah.
To realize he was not suave.
Yeah.
Which also makes him a more obvious, you know, obvious pawn to be manipulated by someone sexually,
Mrs.
especially.
Robinson could not manipulate a young Warren Beatty.
No way.
You know?
No one could, really.
So in the end, Academy Award nominations for picture, actor, actress, supporting actress, adapted screenplay, cinematography, and then Mike Nichols actually won the Academy Award for Best Director. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. This also, you know, this was Mike Nichols' second film.
Wow.
The film that he had done before that was a small film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Oh, jeez.
That
was
the year
first
before
movie.
Also was up for many Academy Awards and
crazy.
Obviously won Best Picture, right?
Yeah.
So that was – this film was 67, right? That was 66.
Wow.
So the producer of this film, he actually hunted down Nichols like years before, and he had directed – Barefoot in the Park on Broadway, which is no small feat, but otherwise was not really a known director.
Yeah.
He was known for his comedy, very much so, but he wasn't really a well-known director. And, he, you know, there was somebody out there that saw, like, you know, this movie might not get made next year or the year after or the year after.
Crazy.
He still had a long way to go, but knew he wanted him as a director.
Wow.
Before they shot the film, he directed several other Broadway shows that did really well, including The Odd Couple and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and then obviously directed the film Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he just, you know, somebody already saw something great in him and pulled him out years before and said, you're the director for this film.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool.
That's amazing.
It's pretty cool.
All right. We finish up with five questions. What's the first movie you remember seeing in the movie theater?
Fantasia.
All right. With a bullet.
Oh, wait. Is that right? Yes. That's definitely right. Fantasia.
First R-rated movie you ever saw anywhere, home or in the theater? Do you know?
What's Top Gun rated? It's like probably like PG-13.
What is Top Gun
rated? I don't
think
it's rated R. I saw that at the drive-in theater with my mom.
Rated R?
My mom worked on the F-14 program, so she took me to go see it at the drive-in because I wasn't allowed to see it, but it still could have been PG-13.
Okay.
Oh, they definitely get it on, and I mean, I was a kid.
All right. We'll call it R-rated. Will you walk out of a bad movie?
No.
You'll stick around, huh?
Definitely.
I don't remember what Sean said.
I'll definitely stick around.
You're probably
First of all, on the same page, though, right?
unless
like the movie was like 7 hours long, like, was it really going to kill me to try it for another hour?
Okay. That's good.
And even if it was something crazy, like super racist or super whatever, I would stick around because I'd be like, please tell me they're doing this satirically and there's a point. And that when I see the point, I'm going to be like, wow.
It was all worth it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fair enough. Number four, what actress do you most wish, and this is at any point in time, you could make a movie with as your co-star, like either a buddy comedy or drama? But as your like equal co-star, dream job.
So weird. I'm just going to say the first person that came to mind, which
perfect.
I don't know if it's really true that I feel that way, but a Constance Zimmer.
Okay.
I think she's a badass and she's had a really cool career.
Nice. Yeah, I love that.
And that was surprising that that's what came out. I wasn't expecting that.
No, I like that. I like that.
Very shocking
gut
answer.
Reaction.
But she's a badass.
All right. And then finally, movie going 101. What is your movie going ritual? Where do you sit? Do you get anything in the concession stands?
No.
Okay. So nothing to eat or drink.
Where
do you sit?
What rituals do I have at a movie? I mean, listen, if I'm going to be making out with somebody, I'm going to sit in the back row. But otherwise, I'm going to go for the best, like, center, top, left.
Okay.
I'll always go towards – I'm left-handed maybe, that's why. I don't know.
Right.
But I always go in the left side. There, that's a ritual.
That is a ritual.
Always from the left.
And I don't think anyone's ever said anything like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Everyone, always from the left.
Okay. All right. That's great. Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you so much.
This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that. It was sort of more of a philosophical discussion than I've had in here about most movies. But I think that is because it is The Graduate, a movie that is very much under the surface of this quote unquote romantic comedy. There's a lot more going on than meets the eye. And I loved watching it again last night, and I love talking to Natasha about it. Very insightful stuff, and she's wonderful. So I hope you enjoyed it too. Go out and watch it again if you didn't watch it before this episode. It is well worth it. It's one of those movies that's well worth seeing like every 6 or 7 years to see what your take is as time marches on for us all. So thanks for tuning in. And until next week, don't go stalk someone at college, man. It makes you a big spineless loser. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at How Stuff Works Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.